Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Attention all posts. This is Lieutenant Junior Grade Esme Suiza, assuming command of the patrol craft Despite, upon the deaths of all officers senior in the chain of command. We're going back.
Junior Lieutenant Suiza, you saved my favorite niece, Commander Serrano. And I won't forget that. I'll be keeping an eye on your career, Lieutenant. I think you have more potential than even you suspect.
Graphic Audio presents The Serrano Legacy by Elizabeth Moon.
It is my duty to inform you that you have all been called before a court. The junior lieutenants can expect to see charges of both treason and mutiny.
Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Elizabeth Demery, Stephen Carpenter, Sherry Simpson, Terrence Aselford, Christopher Graybill, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Eric Messner, Michael John Casey, Peter Stray, Sonny Lasky, Lily Beacon, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, James Lewis, Colleen Delaney, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, and Mort Shelby. Book 4, Once a Hero, Part 1.
Esme Suiza had done her best to clean up before reporting as ordered to the Admiral aboard her flagship, the RSS Harrier, but the mutiny and the following battle had left her little time. She had showered and run her uniform through the cycler, but it wasn't her dress uniform. The fight aboard Despite had put holes through interior bulkheads and started innumerable small fires, including one in the junior officer's storage compartment. She herself, though clean, had not slept well in however many days it had been. She knew her eyes were bloodshot and sticky with fatigue. Her hands trembled. She had the stomach-clenching feeling that her best wasn't good enough. Admiral Serrano looked like an older edition of Captain Serrano. The same compact trim frame, the same bronze skin. Here, the dark hair was streaked silver, and a few lines marked the broad forehead, but she gave an impression of crackling energy held just in check.
Lieutenant Junior Grade Suiza reporting, sir.
At least her voice didn't shake. Those few days of command had ironed out the uneasy flutter she used to struggle against.
Have a seat, Lieutenant.
Esme sat in the appointed chair, glad that her knees held, and she made it a controlled descent.
I have reviewed your summary of events aboard Despite. It seems to have been a very difficult time.
Yes, sir.
That was safe. But her memory reminded her that it wasn't always true, that a yes, sir, to Captain Hearn had been treason, and a yes, sir, to Major Dovere had been mutiny.
You do understand, Lieutenant, that it is mandatory for all officers participating in a mutiny to stand before a court to justify their actions.
Esme was grateful for the gentleness, even though she knew it would do her no lasting good.
Yes, sir. I have to take responsibility.
That's right. And you, because you are the senior surviving officer and the one who ended up in command of the ship, you will bear the brunt of this investigation and the court.
The Admiral paused, looking at her with that quiet, expressionless face. Esme felt cold inside. They had to have a scapegoat, is that what it meant? Panic filled in a quick sketch of her future. Dismissed, disgraced, thrown out of fleet, and forced to return home. She wanted to argue that it wasn't fair, but she knew better. Fairness wasn't the issue here. The survival of ships, which depended on the absolute obedience of all to the captain, that was the issue.
I understand.
I won't tell you that such a court is merely a formality, even in a case like this. A court is never a mere formality. Things always come out in courts to the detriment of everyone concerned. Things that might not matter ordinarily. But in this case, I don't want you to panic. It is clear from your report, and that of other personnel...
Esme hoped that might mean the Admiral's niece.
...that you did not instigate the mutiny, and that there is reasonable probability that the mutiny will be held to be justified.
The knot in Esme's stomach loosened slightly.
Obviously, it is necessary to remove you from command of despite.
Esme felt her face heating, more relief than embarrassment. She was so tired of having to figure out how to ask the senior NCOs what to do next without violating protocol.
Of course, sir.
Frankly, I'm surprised that a Jig could take over despite and handle her in battle, let alone get off the decisive shot. That was good work, Lieutenant.
Thank you, sir. Actually, it was the crew, especially Chief Essek. They knew what to do.
They always do. But you had the sense to let them, and the guts to come back. You're young. You made mistakes, of course.
Esme thought of their first attempt to join the fight, the way she'd insisted on too high an insertion velocity and forced them to blow past. She hadn't known then about the glitch in the nav computer, but that was no excuse.
But I believe you have the root of the matter in you. Stand your court. Take your medicine, whatever it is, and good luck to you, Lieutenant Suiza.
The Admiral stood. Esme scrambled up to shake the hand extended to her. She was being dismissed. She didn't know where she was going or what would happen next, but she felt a warm glow where the cold knot had been. As the escort outside made clear, where she was going was a quarantined section of officers' country on the flagship. Pelly and the few other junior officers were already there, stowing their duffels in the lockers and looking glum.
Well, she didn't eat you alive. I suppose my turn's coming. What's she like?
A Serrano.
That should be enough. Esme wasn't about to discuss an admiral's character on board a ship.
There's a court coming, but you know that.
At the moment, I'm just as glad you had the seniority and not me, though we're all in trouble.
Esme had been glad to lay down command, but just for a moment she wanted it back so she could tell Pelly to be quiet. And so she would have something to do. It took only a minute or two to stow her own meager duffel in the compartment she'd been assigned, and only another to wonder how much the officer evicted from it would resent having to double up with someone else. Then she was faced with blank walls, or an empty passage, or the cluster of fellow mutineers in the tiny wardroom, which was all the common space they would have until the Admiral decreed otherwise. Esme lay back on her bunk and wished she could turn off the relentless playback in her head that kept showing her the same gruesome scenes over and over and over.
Why do they seem worse each time?
Of course they're listening.
Esme paused in the wardroom entrance. Four of the others were there, listening to Pelly. He looked up, his glance including her in the conversation.
We have to assume they're monitoring everything we say and do.
That's standard, even in normal situations.
Yes, but now they're paying attention.
One of Esme's own stomach-clenching fears was that the forensic team sent to despite would find out that she talked in her sleep.
Well, we didn't do anything wrong. We weren't traitors, and we didn't lead the mutiny either. So I don't see where they can do anything to us.
Not to you, Arpan, no. From this, if nothing else, ensigns are safe. Although you could die of fright facing the court.
Why should I face a court?
Arpan, like Esme, had come to the Academy from a non-service family. Unlike Esme, he had come from an influential non-service family with friends who held seats in council, and he expected family clout to get him out of things.
Regulations. You were a commissioned officer serving aboard a vessel on which a mutiny occurred. You will stand before a court.
Esme didn't mind Pelly's brutal directness so much when it was aimed at someone else, but she knew he'd be at her soon enough.
But don't worry. You're unlikely to spend very long at hard labor. Esme and I, on the other hand... Esme and I are the senior surviving officers. Questions will be asked. They decide to make an example, we are the ones to be made an example of. Jigs are an eminently expendable class.
Arpan looked at both of them. and then without another word squeezed past two of the others and Esme at the door.
Avoiding contamination.
Liam Lavati. He was another Jig, junior to Pelly, but part of Pelly's expendable class. Serviced the Corps and for many generations on both sides of the family. He could afford to sound cheerful. He probably had a dozen cousins who had just outgrown whatever uniforms he needed. Pelly rolled his eyes.
Just as well. I don't like whiners. Do you know he wanted me to press the Admiral for damage payments to replace a ruined uniform?
And he's rich!
Esme could not help thinking what the necessary replacements were going to do to her small savings.
Speaking of the court, what are the uniform protocols?
Uniforms! You too?
For the court, Pelly, not for display.
Oh, right. I don't really know. The only things I've seen were those cubes back at the academy in military law classes. And that was usually just the last day, the verdict. I don't know if they wore dress the whole time.
The thing is, if we need to have new uniforms made, we have to have time for it.
Good point. There wasn't much left of the stuff in that compartment, so we have to assume that all our dress uniforms were damaged. You'll have to ask about it, Esme. You're still the senior.
Not anymore.
Even as she said it, Esme knew that was wrong.
On this you are. Sorry, Es.
Asking about the uniforms brought her to the notice of the paper pushers again. As captain, even for those few days, she had the responsibility to sign off on all the innumerable forms required.
Not the death letters. The Admiral felt that the families would prefer to have those signed by a more senior officer who could better explain the circumstances.
Esme had completely forgotten that duty. The captain must write to the family of any crew members who died while assigned to the ship. She felt herself blushing.
And there are other major reports which the Admiral feels should be deferred until forensics has completed its examination. But you left a lot of routine stuff undone, Sweeza.
Yes, sir.
When could I have done it? How could I have known?
The excuses raced through her mind and out again. No excuses were enough. Lieutenant Commander Hosry handed her a sheaf of paper.
Have your officers fill out these forms. Turn them in completed and countersigned by you within 48 hours, and I'll forward them to the Admiral's staff for approval. If approved, that will authorize officers to arrange for replacements of uniforms, and yes, that will include fleet authorization to forward measurements to registered tailors so they can get started. Now, we need to deal with the basic reports that should have been filed or ready to file at the time when you were relieved of command of Despite.
The junior officers were not delighted with the forms. Some of them procrastinated, and Esme found herself having to nag them to finish the paperwork by the deadline. Hosry's senior clerk looked up when Esme brought the reports in. He glanced at the clock.
None too early. What'd you do, wait until the last minute?
Esme didn't like this clerk, and she had had to work with him for two straight shifts on the incomplete reports Hosry thought she should do. Just let it be over with, she told herself, even though she knew that the reports were the least of her problems. While she worked on those, the other young officers faced daily sessions with investigators, determined to find out exactly how it was that an RSS patrol ship had been captained by a traitor and then embroiled in mutiny. Her turn would come next. Forensics had swarmed over the Despite, stripping the records from the automatic surveillance equipment, searching every compartment, questioning every survivor, examining all the bodies in the ship's morgue. Esme could only imagine that search from the questions they asked each day. First, with no visual cues at all, when they asked her to explain, moment by moment, where she had been and what she had seen, heard, and done when Captain Hearn took the ship away from Xavier. Later, with a 3D display of the ship, they led her through it again. Exactly where had she been? Facing which way? When she said she saw Captain Hearn the last time, where was Hearn, and what had she been doing? Esme had never been good at this sort of thing. She found out quickly that she had apparently perjured herself already. She could not, from where she remembered she'd been sitting, have seen Lieutenant Commander Forrester come out of the cross corridor the way she'd said. It was, the interrogator pointed out, physically impossible to see around corners without special instruments. Had she had any? No. But her specialty had been scan. Was she sure she had not rigged something up? And again here, lines of her earlier testimony moved down the monitor alongside the image of the ship. Could she explain how she had gotten from her own quarters back here all the way forward and down two decks in only 15 seconds? Because there was a clear picture of her, she recognized herself with familiar distaste, in the access corridor to the forward portside battery at 18:30:15, when she had insisted she was in her own quarters for the 18:30 duty report.
I have no idea.
Esme had made a habit of being in her quarters for that duty report. It had meant that she didn't have to linger in the junior officer's wardroom and join the day's gossip, or make her report with the others. Surely she would have done so even more readily with the rumors than sweeping the ship. She didn't like rumors. Rumors got you in trouble. People fought over rumors, and then were in more trouble. She hadn't known that Captain Hearn was a traitor. Of course she hadn't. But she had had an uneasy feeling in the pit of her stomach, and she had tried not to think about it. Not until she'd been dragged through it again did she remember that someone had paged her and told her to come initial the daily scan log of the warhead lockers. Checking the automatic scans had been part of her daily routine. She'd insisted that she had done it, and whoever it was had insisted she hadn't. And finally, she'd gone down to see. Who had called her? She didn't remember. And what had she found when she got there?
I'd made an error entering the scan code. At least, I guess that's what it was.
What do you mean?
Well, the number was wrong. Sometimes that happened, but usually it wouldn't enter. It would signal a conflict.
Explain, please.
Yes, sir. You see, during my rotation, I've entered many scan log codes, probably thousands. I'll admit I've made mistakes, but when that happens, the coder generally locks and refuses entry. On rare occasions in the past, the coder has accepted the incorrect code. When the next shift came on and compared the code to mine, the coder would hang up on them. Then they called me, and I'd have to come myself and reset the code and initial the change. That must be what happened.
I see. And from what station did you make the 1830 report, then?
Esme had no idea. Going from her quarters, she could see the route clearly in her mind, but she could not remember calling in. Yet, if she hadn't, someone would have logged it. Except that was when, up on the bridge, the mutineers made their move against Captain Hearn. Sometime around then, anyway.
I don't know that I did. I don't remember that I didn't. I got to the weapons bay, reset the codes, initialed them, and came back to my quarters. And then...
By then, the mutiny had spread beyond the bridge, and the senior mutineers had sent someone down to keep the juniors out of it if they could. That hadn't worked. There had been more traitors than that. The investigator nodded shortly and went on to something else. To a series of somethings else. Finally, over many sessions, they worked their way up to the time when she herself was in charge. Could she explain her decision to return to the Xavier system and try to fight a battle against odds with no senior officers and substantial casualties? Only briefly and obliquely had she allowed herself to think of her decision as heroic. Reality wouldn't let her dwell on it. She hadn't known what she was doing. Her inexperience had caused too many deaths. Even though it came out all right in the end, in one way, it was not all right for those who had died. If it wasn't heroic, what was it? It looked stupid now, foolhardy. Yet her crew, despite her inexperience, had blown away the enemy flagship.
I remembered Commander Serrano. I had to come back. After sending a message, so in case...
Gallant, but hardly practical. You're a protege of Commander Serrano.
No.
Not a, particular friend?
Esme barely kept herself from snorting. What did he think she was, some prude off a backcountry planet that didn't know one sex from the other? That could not call things by their right names?
No. We were not lovers. We were not friends. She was a major, command track. I was an ensign, technical track. It's just that she was polite.
Others weren't?
Not always. I'm not from a fleet family. I'm from Altiplano, the first person from Altiplano to attend the academy.
Altiplano, yes. That is a planet where the ageist influence is particularly strong, isn't it?
Ageists?
Esme scrambled through what she knew of politics at home. She had not been home since she was 16, and came up with nothing.
I don't think anyone in Altiplano hates old people.
No, no. Aegis. Surely you know. They oppose rejuvenation.
Oppose rejuvenation? Why?
How closely do you follow events on Altiplano?
I don't.
Esme had left it behind gladly. She had discarded, without watching, the NewsCube subscription her family sent her. She had finally decided, in the bleak aftermath of a nightmare in which she was not only stripped of her commission but sentenced to a term of hard labor, that she would never go back to Altiplano, no matter what. They could throw her out of Fleet, but they couldn't make her go home. She had looked it up. No judicial action could force someone to return to their planet of origin for crimes committed somewhere else.
And I can't believe they really oppose rejuvenation. At least, I can't imagine anyone I know thinking that way.
Oh?
Since he seemed interested, the first person in years who had shown any interest at all, Esme found herself telling him about Papa Stefan, Sani, Bertol, and the rest, at least insofar as it bore on their likely attitude towards rejuve.
And is your family, prominent on Altiplano?
My father's a regional commander in the militia. The ranks aren't equivalent, but there are only 4 regional commanders on Altiplano.
And you chose to go into Fleet. Why?
Esme had dealt with that in her first application, and during the entrance interviews, and the military psychology classes as well. She rattled off the explanation that had always seemed to go best, and it sank into the investigator's unresponsive gaze.
Is that all?
Well, yes.
The smart young officer did not talk about wish fulfillment, the hours she'd spent in the manor orchard staring up at the stars and promising herself she'd be there someday. Better to be matter-of-fact, practical, sensible. No one wanted wild-eyed dreamers, fanatics, especially not from worlds that had only a couple of centuries of human colonization.
I loved the thought of going into space.
Esme felt herself flushing, the telltale heat on her face and neck. She hated her fair skin that always showed her emotions. The interrogator touched his stylus to his data pad.
Well, Lieutenant, that will be all.
For now, his look said. It could not be the end of questioning. That wasn't how things worked. Esme said nothing except the polite formula he expected and went back to her temporary quarters. She had not realized until the second or third shift aboard the flagship that only she, of the young mutineers, had a private compartment. She wasn't sure why, since there were 3 other women, all crammed into one compartment. She'd have been happy to share. Well, not happy, but willing. But the Admiral's orders left no room for argument, as Esme found when she asked the officer assigned as their keeper if she could change the arrangement. He'd looked disgusted and told her no so firmly that her eardrums rattled. So she had privacy if she wanted it. She could lie on her bunk, someone else's bunk, but hers for the duration, and remember, and try to think. She didn't really like either, not alone. She had the kind of mind that worked best alongside others, striking sparks from her own and others' intransigence. Alone, it whirred uselessly, recycling the same thoughts over and over. But the others did not want to talk about what bothered her. No, that was not quite honest. She did not want to talk to them about those things either. She did not want to talk about how she felt when she saw the first casualties of the mutiny. How the smell of blood and scorched decking affected her. How it brought back memories she had hoped were gone forever.
War isn't clean anywhere, Esme.
Her father had said that when she'd told him she wanted to go into space, wanted to become a fleet officer.
Human blood and human guts smell the same. Human cries sound the same.
She had said she knew it. She had thought she knew it. But those hours in the orchard, looking up at the distant stars, clean light on clean darkness, she had hoped for something better. Not security, no. She was too much her father's child to wish for that. But something clean-edged, the danger sharpened by vacuum and weapons that vaporized. She had been wrong, and now she knew it in every reluctant cell of her body.
Esme?
Esme glanced at the timer and sat up hurriedly. She must have dozed off.
I'm coming.
A quick glance in the mirror. She had the flyaway sort of hair that always needed something done to it. She swiped at it, both hands, and palmed the door control. Pelly stood outside, looking worried.
You all right? You weren't at lunch, and now...
Another interview, and I wasn't really hungry anyway. I'm coming.
She wasn't hungry now, either, but skipping meals brought the psych nannies down on you, and she had no desire to be interviewed by yet another set of inquiring minds. Supper sat uneasily in her stomach. She sat in the crowded little wardroom, not really listening to the others talk. It was mostly guesses about where they were and when they would arrive and how long it would take to convene the court. Who would sit on it? Who would represent them? How much trouble this would cause them in the future.
Not as much as being under Captain Hearn if she'd gotten away with it.
Esme hadn't meant to say anything, but she knew she was the only one really at risk in court. And here they were chattering away as if all that mattered was a possible black mark that might keep them from promotion ahead of their group. They stared at her.
What do you mean? Hearn couldn't have gotten away with it. Not unless she took the ship straight over to the Benignity.
Liam Lavati's jaw dropped, and he suddenly looked pale.
Exactly. She could have done that, if Dovere and the other loyalists hadn't stopped her, and we could all be Benignity prisoners.
Dead, or worse than. The others looked at her as if she had suddenly sprouted a full suit of battle armor with weaponry.
Or she could have told Fleet that Harris Serrano was the traitor. The accusations were false, and she had fled to save her ship and crew from a maniac. She could have assumed that no one could defeat a Benignity assault group with only two warships.
And even Harris Serrano had not done so. Esme had recognized the peril even as she ended it. Without her own decisive entry into battle, Serrano would have perished, and all witnesses to Hearn's treachery with her. Pelly and Liam looked at Esme with more respect than she'd had from them yet, even in battle.
Oh, I never thought of all that. It never occurred to me that Hearn could have gotten away with it, but you're right. We might not even have known. Only those on the bridge actually heard Captain Serrano's challenge. If one more bridge officer had been a Benignity agent...
Liam rumpled his Lavati red hair.
We'd be dead. Ooh. I don't like the thought that I might have disappeared that way.
Surely they'd have ransomed us. I know my family...
Traitors. I suppose your family does business with them, eh?
Arpan jumped up, eyes blazing.
I don't have to be insulted by people like you.
As a matter of fact, you do. I outrank you, trade-born infant. You're still just an ensign, in case you hadn't noticed.
This Esme could handle.
No quarreling. Lavati, he can't help who his family is. Arpan, Lavati is your senior. Show respect.
Ooh. The ex-captain remembers the feel of command.
As a matter of fact, I do. And keeping you juniors from messing each other's uniforms is easier than fighting a battle. Shall we keep it that way?
Expressions ranging from surprise to satisfaction met her gaze. She kept the smile on her face, and eventually they all smiled back.
Sure, Esme. I'm sorry, Arpan. I shouldn't have chosen this time, if any, to slang your family. Lieutenant Suiza's right. Friends?
Lavati held out his hand. Arpan, still scowling, finally shook it. It did not escape Esme's notice that Lavati had chosen a combination of address which claimed her as a friend while emphasizing her authority to Arpan. She could do that sort of thing if she thought of it, but she had to think. Liam Lavati and the others born into Fleet families seemed to do it as naturally as breathing. The conference room had been swept and garnished, ensuring that it was empty of the security demons whose probing eyes and ears, and busy tongues, would have had a field day. Outside, two offices away, an efficient receptionist would deal with any calls. The rest of the staff were busy on assigned projects. The three partners who had formed Special Materials Analysis Consulting looked at the moment more like business rivals than old friends. Arhas Asperson, short, compact, dark-haired, leaned forward, elbows on the polished table, as Gori Lansimir reported on the results of clandestine research. Across from him, Losa Aguilar lay back in her chair, consciously opposing him in gesture as in attitudes. The lounging posture did not suit her. With her lean body went an energy usually expressed in action.
You were right, Arhas. In-house projections at Kalmori are that demand will rise steeply, especially for repeat procedures where the last procedure used drugs from a questionable source.
In other words, last week's blip in the price of a first-time rejuvenation wasn't a blip at all.
Gori pointed to details in the chart he'd displayed.
No. Ever since the king resigned, there's been talk about adulteration of the components. The shakeup in the Moraline family holdings suggests to me it may be even bigger than what's alleged in the suits already filed.
I suppose we should be glad we didn't get ours done last year.
Arhas looked at Aguilar. Had there been a hint of smugness in her tone? Probably. Losa enjoyed rightness as a personal fiefdom. Usually he didn't mind, but when she disagreed with him, that buzzsaw certainly hurt.
Not to our credit, since we couldn't afford them last year. Or this, with the price increase. I suppose we could get one of us done.
Arhas glanced at his partners. Gori might go along with that, but Losa never would. Nor would he himself, unless he was the one to get rejuve.
No, for the same reasons we didn't pool funds to do one of us last year.
You don't have to make your distrust quite so obvious. I wasn't suggesting it, only pointing out that we could afford only one this year, too. It's taken us 5 years to save up that much, and with the price expected to rise steeply...
We need more contracts. Surely with all that's happening in the fleet right now, we can find a niche?
We should have an advantage. We shouldn't be under any suspicion like the major suppliers and consulting firms.
That might help.
Arhas had his doubts. Somehow, even when the witch hunters were out, the good old firm seemed to find a safe hideout.
We do good work. We've had fleet contracts through Miziani, if anyone notices the sub-subcontractors at a time like this.
That's what you're worried about? That we're not noticeable enough?
In a way. The thing is, they have no way of knowing whether we subs perform well because we're good, or because we're under the thumb of the main contractor. Thus, no reason to trust us on our own.
We've had a few, but not enough of the juicy ones. Our profit margin's too low.
No. And the real problem, I'm convinced, is that we aren't rejuved yet. The big firms all have rejuved executives now.
We're not that old.
No, but Gori's not as boyishly cute anymore. None of us look like bright young kids. Look, Losa, we've been over this before.
And I didn't like it then.
Losa had abandoned the fake slouch for her more normal upright posture. He had never seen anyone but a dancer with such a back and neck. He could remember the feel of it under his hands. But that had been years ago. Now they were only partners in work. He pulled his mind away from the thought of Losa rejuved to, perhaps, 18.
Look, it's simple. If we want to survive in this field, we have to convince clients we're successful. Successful consultants are rich, and rich people are rejuved. We're still getting contracts, but not the best contracts. In 10 years, the kind of contracts we're getting will go to the new bright young things, or to our present competitors who've managed to afford rejuve.
Well, we could cut back.
They had discussed this before. Even Gori didn't really want to live like an impoverished student again.
No. It's suicide either way. To save out enough for rejuve, even one at a time, we'd have to cut expenses. This office, for one. And that would make us look like losers. We need to rejuve, all of us, within the next 5 years. With the revelations about those contaminated drugs, the price will go up and stay up just when we need it most.
Which comes down to more contracts, except that we can't do more without hiring more, and that drives our cost up.
Maybe. We need some new ideas, contracts that will give us a higher margin of profit and not require any more expenditures.
From your tone, I'd gather you already have some.
Well, yes. There are specialties which pay a much higher rate, for which we are already qualified.
Industrial sabotage? We don't want to try that with Fleet. Not with the current mood.
Public opinion's on their side right now because of the Xavier affair. That Serrano woman is a hero. But in the long run, what they'll remember is one hero and three traitors.
And we're to be traitors, too.
No, not traitors, but... None of us got into this work because of any particular love for the Familius bureaucracy. Remember why we left General Control Systems? And then, as subcontractors, we've had the same piles of paperwork.
You're talking about working outside Familius space? Won't that just mean a whole new set of paper pushers to contend with?
Not necessarily. Not everyone outside is tangled in red tape as the Familius. And it isn't necessarily against Familius interests. At least, I don't see it that way.
You want rejuvenation.
Yes, and so do you, Losa. So does Gori. None of us have been able to increase our profits within the confines of fleet contracts and subcontracts. Too many fish in this pond, many of them with more teeth. So either we give up our ambitions, which I, for one, am not willing to do, or we find another pond. Ideally, a pond that connects with this one, so we don't lose all the goodwill we've built.
All right, Arhas, just tell us.
We have a potential client who would like to have us disable a self-destruct device on a service ship.
Whose service ship? Fleets?
Fleets.
Not blow it up, just disable its self-destruct.
Right.
Why?
In this kind of situation, it's not my business why. Though I could speculate, I'd rather not.
And who is this potential client?
He didn't say whom he worked for, but a little discreet data probe allowed me to estimate a very high probability that he's an agent for Athar's world.
You were talking to the Blood Horde?
Can we trust him?
Not really, but the offer was generous, and I suspect we can work up from it. He didn't sound as firm as he thought.
What kind of service ship?
A deep space repair ship. One of those floating ship factories, crewed like an orbital station. Why anyone would put a self-destruct on it in the first place, I can't understand. Sounds dangerous to me. What if the captain goes crazy? And they want it disabled, is all.
Oh, I hate the idea of dealing with the Blood Horde. And here we're talking about 20 or 30,000 people.
Military personnel, not ordinary people. They signed up for the risk. That's what they're paid for. And we need the cash. If we don't get the new rejuve procedure soon...
But the Blood Horde Arhas! All those hairy, beefy types with their destiny garbage, they belong back on their home planet, whacking each other with clubs and sitting around drunk singing.
Of course they do, Losa. They're barbarians, and we all know it. That's why I'm not worried. Fleet will be able to contain them, just as they always have. And this job doesn't require us to damage Fleet.
Disabling a ship system?
A system that's never been used and never will be. DSRs never get into combat anyway, so I don't know why they even have self-destruct devices. I'd think they'd go the other way, make it impossible to blow them up. But apparently they do have such things, and the person who contacted me wanted it turned off.
It's obvious, Arhas. You can see.
Arhas held up his hand.
I don't want to see. Speculate, rather. It will have no effect on the DSR's function as a repair and maintenance facility. It won't kill anyone. It won't do anything but keep some ham-handed ensign from blowing the ship up by accident. In a way, you could think of our action as damage control. And the good news is, they offered, before I started dickering, a fee that will cover rejuvenation for two of us. I got them up another half mil, and that means we have enough for all three of us. Net, not gross. After the job, of course.
The complete...
You, with the newest certified drugs. A margin for inflation while the job's on.
Rejuve. Just like that Lady Cecilia.
Yes. I thought you'd see it that way.
Arhas cocked his head at Gori.
And you?
I don't like the Blood Horde, what I've heard about them, but, probably most of it's propaganda anyway. If they were so quarrelsome and technologically backward, they wouldn't have been able to hold their empire together the past century. I suppose it's in a solid currency?
Yes.
Well, then I don't see a problem, as long as it's within our technical expertise. As you said, it's not like we're actually doing any damage to a ship or to people's lives. A self-destruct isn't a weapon. We're not really depriving Fleet of anything. But how are we going to get aboard the ship? And where is it?
We're going to get a contract. A legitimate contract. And there's one up for bid, just posted this morning, in fact. All the Fleet weapons inventory needs recalibration. The word is, they're afraid more traitors like Hearn could have diddled the guidance system's codes. It's such a big job, they've decided to put it out to all qualified consultants with the right clearances, regardless of size. I put in our bid on the way back.
But what if we'd said no to the other job?
Then we'd have had a legitimate job. I bid for the contract in Sector 14 only, giving as a reason our small staff. It was listed as a bonus project because of the distance from Major Nexi. I think we fit that profile very well. And besides, we can dicker with whoever gets it if we don't.
As long as we do get paid.
Oh, we will. The Blood Horde representative is coming tomorrow. Standard first visit negotiations, but I want full security backup. He's likely to turn mean. For all that, he's wearing a suit. He won't know about the other contract, and I'm going to try to get an additional travel and expense budget out of him.
Who else are we taking in on this job?
The fleet part of it, the usual team. This part, only the three of us. We don't want to share the fee, after all.
Arhas glanced across the broad desk at the blonde man in the expensive business suit, who lounged back in his chair as if it were a throne, a posture which made the suit look as if it had been made for someone else, someone who knew how to sit without sprawling.
There's only one tricky point. That's the civilian fleet interface on Sierra. It's the Sector HQ of a red zone sector. They do more than just glance at ID there.
Your IDs will be in order.
We could avoid the problem entirely by traveling with fleet from somewhere else. Comus, for instance.
No.
Explain.
It is not my place to explain. It is yours to comply with the contract.
It is not my place to be stupid.
With a flick of his gaze, Arhas ensured the blonde man's continued existence for a space of time. How long depended on his mood, which the blonde man was not helping. He reminded himself that the consulting fee transferred to the firm's account would pay for 3.5 rejuvenations at the rate that Gori had calculated would apply when they were through with the job. Fleet's fee for recalibrating all those weapons would give them something to live on. If they killed this messenger, they would have to deal with someone who might be worse.
If you want this done neatly, as you said, then you should listen to the experts.
Expert sneaks.
Clearly, the blonde man had no respect, a condition dangerous in itself, beyond unpleasant. Arhas allowed an eyelid to droop. Before it rose again, the blonde man was gasping for breath, the noose around his thick neck grooving the skin. The chair in which he sat had flipped restraints onto his arms and tightened them. Arhas did not move.
Insults annoy us. We are experts. That's why you hired us. It is part of our expertise to travel unnoticed, accepted. It is my opinion that waiting until Sierra Station to enter fleet jurisdiction will bring unwelcome notice. Civilian contractors, special consultants, normally join up with fleet transport closer to their point of origin.
Arhas smiled. The blonde man's face had turned an ugly puce, but the blue eyes showed no fear, not even as they dulled with oxygen deprivation. He nodded, and the noose sprang away from the blonde man's neck.
Mother devouring scum!
The blonde man yanked hard, but the chair restraints held his arms down.
No. Experts. You pay us. We do your job. Cleanly. Thoroughly. But don't insult us.
You will regret this.
I don't think so. It is not my neck which has a mark from a noose. Nor will it.
If I were loose...
I would have to kill you if you attacked me. It would be most unfortunate.
You... You are too little.
Bloodhorde barbarian.
Losa had said nothing before now, projecting a quiet demeanor that fit the subordinate role she had seemed to have, a role the blonde man had been brought up to expect from women.
Do you still think size is everything, after all your defeats?
Peace, Losa. It is no part of our contract to instruct this individual in the realities of hand-to-hand fighting. We have no reason to give him gratuitous data.
As you wish.
Now, we will expect half the fee on deposit with our bankers by midday tomorrow, the next fourth when we arrive at Sierra Station, and the final fourth when we have completed the task. No, don't argue. You lost your bargaining advantage when you insulted us. You can always hire someone else if you don't like my terms. You won't find anyone as good. You know that already. But it's your choice. Take it or leave it. Which?
Take, greedy swine.
Very good.
No need to mention that every insult now, after that warning, would raise the price of the job. One did not have to like one's customers if they produced enough profit, and Arhas, the best in his field, knew to a single credit how much it took to satisfy his feelings. Although the job itself was intriguing, a challenge he would not have thought of by himself, but one well worth the attempt.
Not the attempt, the achievement.
He had no doubts. They had not failed in an assignment in years. Getting this buffoon out of the office quietly was the only problem that concerned him once the buffoon had thumbprinted a credit authorization. After the blonde man left, Losa looked at Arhas skeptically.
Nasty and dangerous.
Yes, but solvent. We don't have to like them.
You said that before.
It's true.
He scared me. He wasn't afraid. He was just angry. What if they want revenge for the insult?
Arhas looked at her and wished she'd make up her mind what kind of person she was.
Losa, this is a dangerous business, and it's never bothered you before. We have good security. We'll be taking precautions. Do you want that rejuvenation, or don't you?
Oh, of course I want it.
I think you're just annoyed that I found the contract and not you.
Maybe. No, I must need one. I'm turning into a cautious old lady before my time.
You're not an old lady, Losa. And now, you never will be.
By the time the flagship reached Sector Headquarters, Esme had begun thinking of the court as a door to freedom. Freedom from the tensions and rivalries of a cluster of scared junior officers with not enough to do. While it made legal sense, she supposed, to keep them all isolated and relatively idle, it felt like punishment. Even the largest ship has limited resources for recreation. Duties normally fill most of its crew's time. Esme tried to make herself use the teaching cubes. She encouraged the others to use them. But with a knot of uncertainty lodged in the middle of her brain, the rest of it couldn't concentrate on anything as dry as methods for backflushing filters in a closed system, or communications protocols for fleet vessels operating in zones classified F and R. As for the tactical cubes, she already knew where she'd gone wrong by going back to Xavier, and there was nothing she could do about it now. Besides, none of the tactical cubes considered the technical problems she'd faced in starting a battle with a ship which had suffered internal damage in a mutiny. She could not work hard enough by day to ensure restful sleep at night. Physical exhaustion might have done that, but her share of the gym time wasn't enough to achieve that. So the nightmares came, night after night, and she woke sweat-soaked and gritty-eyed. The ones she understood were bad enough. Replays of the mutiny or the battle at Xavier, complete with sound and smell. But others seemed to have drawn from memories of every training film, every military gory story she'd ever heard, all jumbled together like the vivid shards of a shattered bowl. She looked up at a killer's face. She looked down to see her own hands slimy with blood and guts. She stared into the muzzle of a Pierce Schochin 382, which seemed to widen until her whole body could slide down inside it.
No! No! Stop! No!
That time when she woke, tangled in damp bedding, someone was pounding on her door.
Esme? Esme!
Yes?
It was not a door, but a hatch. She was not home, but aboard a ship, which was better than home.
I'm all right. Just a bad dream.
Some of us need our sleep too, you know.
Sorry.
Esme struggled with a rush of sudden, inexplicable anger, which urged her to yank open the hatch, not door, and strangle the speaker. It was the situation. Tempers would naturally flare, and she must set an example. She lay back against the bulkhead, the safe, gray bulkhead, thinking. She had not had such dreams in years, not since leaving home for the Fleet Prep School. Even at home, they'd been rarer as she got older, although they had been frequent enough to worry her family. Her stepmother and her father had both explained, at tedious length, their origin. She had run away once, after her mother died, a stupid and irresponsible act mitigated by youth, and the fact that she was probably already sick with the same fever that killed her mother. She had found trouble, a minor battle in the insurrection now known as the Califer Uprising. Her father's troops had found and rescued her, but she'd nearly died of the fever. Somehow, what she'd seen and heard and smelled had tangled with the fever during the days in coma and left her with the bad dreams of something which had never really happened. Not as she dreamed it, anyway. It made sense that being in a real battle would bring back those old memories and the confusion the fever engendered. She really had smelled spilled guts before. Smells were particularly evocative. That was in the psychology books she had read secretly in Papa Stefan's library, when she had believed she was crazy as well as lazy and cowardly and stupid. And now that she understood where the nightmares had been leading, Trying to link her past experiences with her present, she could deal with this consciously. She had had nightmares because she needed to make the connection, and now that she had it, she would not need the nightmares. She fell asleep abruptly, dreaming no more until the bell signaled the time to wake. That day, she congratulated herself on figuring it out and instructed herself to have no more nightmares. She was tense at bedtime, but talked herself out of it. If she dreamed, she did not remember it, and no one complained of the noise she made. Only once more before they reached Sector HQ did she have a nightmare, and that one was even easier to understand. She dreamt she came into the court-martial, and only when the presiding officer spoke discovered that she was stark naked. When she tried to run out, she could not move. They all looked at her and laughed, and then walked out, leaving her alone. It was almost a relief to find she could have normal nightmares. At Sector HQ, her replacement uniforms were ready, delivered directly to the quarantine section aboard the ship by guards, who clearly felt this beneath their dignity. The new clothes felt stiff and awkward, as if her body had changed in ways that measurements could not reflect. She had used the minimal fitness equipment in the quarantine section daily, so the difference wasn't flab. It was something more mental than physical. For the first time, the young officers were called before the Admiral as a group. Esme wore a new uniform, so did everyone else. An armed escort led them. Another closed in behind. Esme tried to breathe normally, but could not help worrying. Had something else gone wrong? What could it be? Admiral Serrano waited, expressionless, as they all filed into the office, packed in so close that Esme could smell the new fabric of their uniforms. The Admiral had responded to each formal greeting with a little nod and a flick of her eyes to the next in line.
It is my duty to inform you that you have all been called before a court to explain, if you can, the events leading up to the mutiny aboard Despite and the subsequent involvement of that ship and crew in action at Xavier.
Esme heard nothing from behind her, but she felt the reaction of her fellow officers. Though they had known it must happen, the formal words delivered by an admiral of the fleet struck with awesome force. Court-martial. Some officers served from commissioning to retirement without being threatened with an investigation, let alone a hearing before some board, and certainly without standing a court-martial. A court-martial was the ultimate disgrace if you were convicted. It was a blemish on your career even if you were acquitted.
Because of the complexity of this case, the Judge Advocate General has chosen to handle it with utmost circumspection, but also utmost gravity. The precise charges have not been determined for each of you, but in general, the junior lieutenants can expect to see charges of both treason and mutiny, which the JAG is not considering mutually exclusive defenses, one for the other. That is, if you were a party to treason, this does not defend against a later charge of mutiny, and vice versa.
The Admiral's bright black eyes seemed to bore into Esme's. Did she mean something particular about that? Esme wanted to blurt out that she was not and had never been a traitor, but discipline kept her jaw locked.
I am authorized to tell you that the reason for this is the high level of concern about benignity influence in the officer corps. It would not have been feasible to ignore that possibility in this case. Your defense counsels will explain it to you. The ensigns are being charged with mutiny only, except in one case where investigation is still in progress.
But we haven't even seen a defense lawyer.
Ensign Arpan, isn't it? Did anyone give you leave to interrupt, Ensign?
No, sir. But
then be silent.
The Admiral looked back at Esme, who felt guilty that she had not somehow gagged Arpan, but the Admiral's look conveyed no rebuke.
Junior Lieutenant Suisa, as the senior surviving officer and former captain of a mutinied ship in combat, your trial will necessarily be severed from that of the officers junior to you, although you will be called to testify in their trials, and they in yours. Additionally, you will face a captain's board of inquiry to investigate your handling of Despite in battle.
Esme had expected this, in one way, and in another had hoped that one investigation and judicial ordeal might subsume the other.
Because of the unusual circumstances of the Xavier situation, including the actions taken by Commander Serrano, it has been determined that you should all be transported to Fleet Headquarters for these courts-martial on another vessel.
Esme blinked. They didn't trust Admiral Serrano because of her niece? Then she remembered all the rumors, now demonstrably untrue, about Harris Serrano and her departure from Fleet.
Commander Serrano will, of course, be facing a board of inquiry herself, and three of you will be called to testify to that board.
Esme could not imagine who might be thought to have useful information there.
You will be allowed communications access to notify your families, and, if possible, speak with them directly. But you are not to communicate with anyone other than your families. Specifically, you are ordered under penalty to avoid discussion of this case with anyone in or out of Fleet, except your defense counsel and each other. I strongly recommend that you not discuss this among yourselves any more than you already have. You will be closely observed, not always by those who have your interests at heart. You will be met at Fleet Headquarters by your assigned defense counsel, and you will have the usual resources then to prepare yourself for court.
The Admiral's gaze raked the lines for a moment. Esme hoped no one would ask stupid questions, and no one did.
You're dismissed, except for Junior Lieutenant Suisa.
Esme's heart sank through her boot soles and the deck she stood on. She stood while the others shuffled out, watching the Admiral's face for any clue.
Sit down, Lieutenant Suisa. This is going to be a difficult time for you, and I want to be sure you understand that. Yet I don't want to panic you. Unfortunately, I really don't know you well enough to know how much warning it takes to scare you too much. Your record as an officer doesn't help me along. Can you?
Esme had no idea what to say. For once, yes, sir, wasn't enough.
You did very well at the Academy Prep School. You were rated high, not brilliantly, in the Academy itself. I would guess you're not the sort to look up your own fitness reports. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
So you may not know that you've been described as hard worker, willing, not a leader, or steady, competent, always completes assignments, shows initiative with jobs but not people, leadership potential average.
The Admiral looked at her, but Esme couldn't think of anything. That's about what she'd thought of herself.
In a lifetime in the Fleet, Lieutenant Suisa, I've never seen this sort of fitness report, one after another, from prep school all the way through, coupled with the kind of decisive leadership you showed with Despite. I've known some quiet, unassuming officers who were good in combat, but there was always, somewhere in the background, at least one little glint from that undiscovered diamond.
It was an accident. And besides, it was the crew who did it, really.
Accidents do not just happen. Accidents are caused. What kind of accident do you think would have resulted if Junior Lieutenant Levadi had been senior?
Esme had wondered that. In the aftermath of battle, Liam and Pelly both had been sure they would have chosen a different insertion velocity and vector. But she remembered the look on their faces when she announced they were going back.
You don't have to answer. I know from his interviews. He would have sent the same message you did, and then hopped back to Sector HQ, hoping to find someone handy. He would not have taken Despite back. And although he can justly critique your tactics on system entry, he himself would have been far too late to save the situation.
I'm not sure. He's brave.
Courage isn't the whole issue here, and you know it. Prudence and courage make good teammates. Cowardice can be as rash as story cube courage.
The Admiral smiled, and Esme felt cold.
Lieutenant, if you can puzzle me, I assure you that you are puzzling the rest of the fleet even more. It's not that they don't want you to have done what you did, but they don't understand it. If you can hide that level of ability all these years under a bland exterior, what else are you hiding? Some have even suggested that you are a Benignity deep agent, that you somehow set up Commander Hearn and engineered a mutiny just to get yourself known as a hero.
I didn't.
I don't think so myself. But right now, there's a crisis of confidence all over the Familius Regnant, and it has not spared the regular space service. It was bad enough to discover that Lepescu was making sport of killing fleet personnel, but to find that three traitorous captains could be dispatched to something like Xavier, that has shaken the confidence of fleet intelligence as well it should. By all rights, you should be whisked through the obligatory court as quickly as possible, and then hailed as the hero you are. And don't bother to deny it. You are. Unfortunately for you, circumstances are against you. And I expect you and your defense counsel will have a rugged few weeks. Nor is there anything I can do about it. Right now, my influence could only harm you.
That's all right.
I wish I knew you and your background better. I can't even tell if you're sitting there complacent, reasonably wary, or terrified. Would you mind enlightening me?
Numb. I'm certainly not complacent. I wasn't complacent even before your warning. I know that young officers who get involved with mutinies, for whatever reason, always have a stained record. But whether I'm reasonably wary or terrified, that I don't know myself.
Where did you develop that kind of control, then, if you don't mind my asking? Usually our intakes from colonial planets are all too easy to read.
The Admiral knows about my father?
One of four sector commanders on Altiplano. I presume that means you grew up in some kind of military household. But most planetary militia are less formal than we are.
It began with Papa Stefan.
Esme was not entirely sure it had really begun there, because how had Papa Stefan accumulated the experience he passed on?
It's not like Fleet, but there's a hereditary military. At least, the leading families are.
But your file says you were raised on a farm of some sort.
Estancia. It's more than a farm, and fairly big.
Fairly big hardly described it. Esme didn't even know how many hectares were in the main holding.
But Papa Stefan insisted that all the children have some military training as they grew.
Not all military traditions value the absolute control of facial expression and emotion. I gather yours does.
Mostly.
Esme couldn't explain her own aversion to the unnecessary display of emotion without going into the whole family mess. Bertol and Sonny and the rest. Certainly, Papa Stefan and her own father valued self-control, but not to the degree she practiced it.
Well, I wanted you to know that you have my best wishes in this matter. After all, you saved my favorite niece. Excuse me, Commander Serrano. And I won't forget that, no matter what. I'll be keeping an eye on your career, Lieutenant. I think you have more potential than even you suspect.
Esme had time to meditate on those words as the long arm of the fleet's judicial branch separated her from the other junior officers, put her aboard a courier escort, and whisked her to fleet headquarters a full 8 days before the others arrived. She met her defense counsel, a balding, middle-aged major who looked more like a bureaucrat than an officer. He had the incipient paunch of someone who avoided the gym, except in the last few weeks before the annual physical fitness test. Major Chapin shook his head, poring over Esme's file.
It would have made sense for them to link the cases. Starting at the back end, you're the hero of Xavier, you saved the planet, the system, and an admiral's niece's ass. Unfortunately...
It was explained to me.
Good. At least none of the records are missing. We'll need to prepare separately for the captain's board of inquiry and for each of the main threats of the court-martial. I hope you have an organized mind.
I think so.
Good. For the time being... Forget military protocol if you can. I'm going to call you Esme, and you're going to call me Fred, because we have too much work to let formality slow us down. Clear?
Yes, sir. Fred.
Good. Now, tell me everything you told the investigators, and then everything you didn't tell them. The whole story of your life isn't too long. I won't get bored, and I don't know what's useful until I hear it.
In the next few days, Esme found that Major Chapin meant what he'd said. She also found herself increasingly comfortable talking to him, which made her nervous. She reminded herself that she was a grown-up, not a child who could throw herself at any friendly adult when she needed comfort. She even mentioned the nightmares, the ones connected to Xavier.
You might want to consider a psych session if it's bothering you that much.
It's not now. It was those first days after.
Sounds normal to me. If you're sleeping well enough to stay alert, there's an advantage in not going for a psych evaluation now, you see, because it might look as if we're going to plead mental incompetence.
Oh.
But by all means, if you need it.
I don't.
Good. Now, about this petty thievery you said was plaguing the enlisted lockers?
Circumstances conspired to shift the date of the court-martial so that the captain's board met first.
You don't take counsel to a board of inquiries, so you'll have to remember everything we've talked about by yourself. You can always ask for a short recess and come ask me, but it leaves a bad impression. Damn it. I wanted you to have experience before you went in alone.
Can't be helped.
Chapin looked mildly surprised, which almost annoyed her. Had he expected Esme to complain when it would do no good? To make a useless fuss? And to him?
Huh? I'm glad you're taking it that way. Now, if they don't bring up the matter of the damage to the nav computer, you have two choices.
That session went on for hours until Esme felt she understood the point of Chapin's advice, as well as the advice itself. The morning the board hearing began, Chapin walked her into the building and all the way to the anteroom where he would wait in case she asked for a recess and his guidance.
Chin up, Lieutenant. Keep in mind that you won the battle and didn't lose your ship.
The Board of Inquiry made no allowances for the irregular way in which Esme had arrived in command of Despite, or so it seemed from the questions. If a Jig commanded in battle, that Jig had better know what she was doing, and every error Esme made came up. Even before the next senior officer died of wounds, why had she not prepared for command? Surely that mess on the bridge could have been cleaned up faster. Esme, remembering the near panic, the need to secure every single compartment, check every single crew member, still thought there were more important things than cleaning blood off the command chair. She didn't say that, but she did list the other emergencies that had seemed more pressing. The board chair, a hard-faced one-star admiral Esme had never heard anything about, good or bad, listened to this with compressed lips and no expression she could read. Why, when she took command, had she chosen to creep into one system, the right move, all agreed, given what she found, and then go blazing back into Xavier, where she had every reason to believe an enemy force lay in wait? Didn't she realize that more competent mining of the jump point entry corridor would have made that suicidal? Esme wasn't about to argue that her decision made sense. She had followed an instinct, not anything rational, and instincts killed more often than they saved. And why hadn't she thought of using a micro-jump to kill momentum earlier, when she might have saved two ships and not just one? Esme explained about the nav computer, the need to patch a replacement chip from one of the missile control units. And on, hour after hour. They seemed far less interested, in fact, not interested at all, in how the Despite had blown the enemy flagship than in her mistakes. The board replayed surveillance material, pointed out discrepancies, lectured, and when it was over at last, Esme went out feeling as if she'd been boiled until all her bones dissolved in the soup. Major Chapin, waiting in the anteroom, where he'd watched on a video link, handed her a glass of water.
You probably don't believe this, but you did as well as you could, given the circumstances.
I don't think so.
Major Chapin sat watching her until she had finished that glass.
Lieutenant, I know you're tired and probably feel that you've been pulled sideways through a wire gauge, but you need to hear this. Boards of inquiry are supposed to be grueling. That's part of their purpose. You stood up there and told the truth. You didn't get flustered, you didn't waffle, you didn't make excuses. Your handling of the nav computer failure was perfect. You gave them the facts and then dropped it. You let Timmy Warnstadt chew you up one side and down the other, and at the end, you were still on your feet answering stupid questions in a civil tone of voice. I've worked with senior commanders who did worse.
Really?
Esme wasn't sure if it was hope she felt or simply astonishment that someone, anyone, could approve of something she did.
Really? Not only that, remember what I told you at the beginning. You didn't lose your ship, and you made a decisive move in the battle. They can't ignore that, even if they think it was blind accident. And after your testimony, they're much less likely to think it was accidental. I wish they'd asked more about the details. You were right not to volunteer it, since it would have sounded like making excuses, but it annoys me when they ignore briefs. I put it all in. The least they could do is read it and ask the right questions. Of course, there will be negative comments. There always are, if something gets as far as a board. But they know, whether they're willing to admit it or not, that you did well for a junior in combat for the first time.
The door opened, and Esme had to go back. She returned to her place, facing the long table with the five officers.
This is a complicated case, and the board has arrived at a complicated resolution. Lieutenant Sweezer, this board finds that your handling of the despite, from the time you assumed effective command after Dover's wounds rendered him incapable of taking the bridge, to your precipitous return to Xavier, was within the standards expected of a fleet captain.
Esme felt the first quiver of hope that she was not going to be tossed out on her ear just before being imprisoned as the result of the court-martial. Admiral Warnstadt glanced down at his notes.
However, your tactical decisions when you returned to the Xavier system were markedly substandard. This board notes that this was your first experience of combat and your first time in command of a ship. The board makes appropriate allowances for these circumstances. Still, the board recommends that you not be considered for command of a regular space service vessel until you have shown, in combat situations, the level of tactical and operational competence expected of warship commanders.
Esme almost nodded. As Chapin had warned her, and she already understood, they could not ignore her mistakes. Such boards existed to point out to captains that luck, even great good luck, was no substitute for competence. Warnstadt looked up at her again, this time with one corner of that lean mouth tucked up in what might almost be a smile.
On the other hand, the board notes that your unorthodox maneuvers resulted in the defeat of an enemy vessel markedly superior in firepower and mass, and the successful defense of Xavier. You seem well aware of your shortcomings as commander of a ship in combat. The board feels that your character and your deportment are both suitable for command positions in the future, as long as you get the requisite experience first. Few lieutenants junior grade command anything bigger than a shuttle anyway. The board's recommendation should have the effect of giving you time to grow into your potential. Now, a complete transcript of the board's recommendation will be forwarded to you and your counsel at a later date, should you wish to appeal.
Esme knew she would be crazy to appeal. This was the best outcome she could have hoped for.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
She got through the rest of the ritual, the dismissal of the board and the necessary individual acknowledgement of each member, without being fully aware what she said. She wanted to fall into a bed and sleep for a month. But in 3 days, her court-martial would begin.